from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's forum program, within the next few weeks, the United States Supreme Court is set to release several major decisions on a range of hot-button issues, including same-sex marriage and the use of race in undergraduate admissions. New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Toobin joins us to discuss the big cases facing the court and his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. Toobin's other books include the bestseller The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. He joins the forum program after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. New Yorker staff writer and CNN analyst Jeffrey Toobin joins us for this opening forum hour to discuss a number of imminent U.S. Supreme Court rulings of major significance and to talk with us about his latest book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. He's also author of The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, and books about the 2000 election, the O.J. Simpson trial, the one for murder, and the sex scandal of the Clinton administration. He's a former ABC legal analyst and an Emmy Award-winning analyst, and we welcome him back to the forum program for this opening hour. Good to have you back with us.
Good to be with you.
Let me begin by just bringing to listeners' attention the fact that we're still awaiting major rulings on same-sex marriage, on affirmative action, and on voting rights action, Section 5, I hope, which we can all talk about with you, Jeffrey Toobin. But they did rule this morning that Arizona cannot add to federal voter registration requirements by demanding proof of citizenship. This is pretty significant, too, isn't it?
It's somewhat significant. This has not been a major part of the anti-immigration effort around the country, this addition of voting requirements. But it is interesting, particularly because the decision was written by Justice Scalia, who is not usually known to take the liberal side in issues. It was a 7-2 opinion. The only dissenters were Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. But this is a court that is jealous about protecting federal power, usually, and that's what this decision really was about. It was about how Arizona couldn't essentially overrule the federal motor voter law that was designed to make voter registration easier in the early 90s. But it is certainly a decision for those who are trying to make voting a little easier, at least less hard.
As you implied, it's a kind of temporary victory for liberals, and I wonder how this fits in with the thesis in your book, which is that the stability and absence of change on the Supreme Court is what the Obama administration wants, as opposed to the Roberts conservative wing of the court, which wants to overturn precedents.
Well, that's true. There are a lot of cases every year, and not every single one goes according to ideological divisions that we are so familiar with, and this was one of them. And it's worth remembering, out of about 75 cases a year, close 30 or 40% are unanimous. About half are close to unanimous, like this one. But when it comes to the high profile cases, when it comes to same-sex marriage, affirmative action, voting rights, the issues that we're still waiting to hear, I think the ideological divisions will readily assert themselves again, and it will be the liberals who are trying to maintain the status quo, especially on an issue like affirmative action, and the conservatives like Roberts who want to change things.
Well, let's talk for a moment, if we could, about same-sex marriage, because I read your piece in The New Yorker where you talk about the feeling that there's inevitability, that this is going to come down the pike, and the justices are not all that even energetic about it at this point, and battles continue, even though the war, I suspect, from your perspective, is over. In fact, there's a new Pew Research piece of information that came out that newspapers have been supporting 5-1 same-sex marriage. And isn't it possible that they can use standing just to duck?
It certainly is. I'm sure not all of your listeners are fully up on all the technicalities of the two cases before the Supreme Court. It might be worth it just to talk about what specifically is at issue in the Proposition 8 case. You know, obviously people in San Francisco are more familiar with it than most people. But the Proposition 8 overturned the decision of the California Supreme Court saying that California Constitution required the same-sex marriage. Once that decision, once Proposition 8 went into effect, some people in San Francisco who wanted to get married challenged the law. At the time, the Attorney General, who was then Jerry Brown, and the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, refused to defend the law, just as the current Attorney General, Kamala Harris, and Jerry Brown, now the governor, refused to defend the law. There is a procedural question about who can defend the law, because there is no usually it's the state government, and the state government's on the plaintiff's side. That is a way that the Supreme Court could get rid of this case, by saying procedurally it's not fit for consideration without addressing the issue of, is there a constitutional right for gay people to get married? And I think some kind of procedural resolution is certainly a possibility, which would allow the state-by-state process to continue.
And we're talking about Proposition 8, but we also have to bring in the DOMA case, which, as you say, not only the governor and the attorney general of California are opposed to 8, but the president is opposed to DOMA.
Right. And it actually now seems to me, and it's interesting how, you know, the argument clarifies things. I think Proposition the DOMA case is going to be more important than the Proposition 8 case, because DOMA is a law on the federal law on the books. And the law says that even in states where same-sex marriage is legal, even in the 12 states, those marriages will not be recognized by the federal government. So they will not be allowed, married couples, same-sex, will not be allowed to file joint tax returns, get Social Security survivor benefits, just a lot of very practical advantages that married people have. If DOMA stands, all those people will suffer those penalties immediately in a continuing way. The thing about Proposition 8 is I think everyone recognizes in California that if Proposition 8 somehow survives this court test, it's going to go back on the ballot in 2014, and it's going to pass overwhelmingly. The polls are as you know better than I, they're very strongly pro-marriage equality in California. So marriage equality is coming to California. The question is immediately or later. DOMA is not going to be overturned by Congress. So if DOMA doesn't get overturned, that is going to be a big, immediate, practical problem for a lot of married gay people in this country. And that's why I think that Supreme Court case is so important.
Talking with Jeffrey Toobin, who is staff writer for The New Yorker, CNN legal analyst, and author most recently of The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, now available in trade paperback, and his other books include the bestseller, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Let's get back to your thesis about the court and its conservative agenda, because it is a political and partisan agenda as you see things. And the irony may be that Justice Roberts in all this is the visionary who wants change and maybe the radical, and President Obama the conservative.
Right. That's the thesis of the oath. And if you look, I think this is especially true when you look at issues of race. Affirmative action and diversity have become very mainstream causes in recent years. You know, the people who are going to bat for diversity in Friends of the Court brief at the Supreme Court are Fortune 500 companies, military officers. People, by and large, in this country want institutions that are integrated racially, by gender, by sexual orientation. And John Roberts, I think, wants to make one of the touchstones of his tenure as Chief Justice to eliminate any government-sanctioned efforts at diversity, that any consideration of race, whether it's in assigning students to school, whether it's giving people jobs, that is something he regards as unconstitutional. And I think you will see that in his vote on the affirmative action case, which we'll hear about shortly, and the Voting Rights Act case, which is also enormously important.
Well, let's talk about those, if we could, Jeffrey Toobin. The first is Fisher versus the University of Texas. It's a 2003 ruling which allows consideration of race in admissions processes, essentially justifying that by saying diverse education is optimal for the education of all students. Now, as you've pointed out, I think it was in the New Yorker, the kind of questions that we were hearing from Justice Roberts show, well, I suppose what could be described as a bias against that, and that's where he's probably going to stand, as you suggest.
Well, I wouldn't, I wouldn't call it a bias in that it's some sort of improper view. It's just he has a view of the Constitution which suggests that any sort of consideration of race is improper. I mean, the facts of this case comes out of the University of Texas in Austin, and the University of Texas has a admissions plan where 90% of the students are admitted because they are in the top 10 or 15% of their high school class, just a completely non-racial considerations. The 10% who are not admitted through that high school ranking system, race is one factor that the admissions office considers, you know, having a diverse student body. A young woman named Fisher said, I didn't get in because some people whose race was considered did get in. And the Supreme Court took her case seemingly to overturn the 2003 decision that you mentioned by Justice O'Connor that came from the University of Michigan Law School.
It's almost as if with Justice O'Connor leaving the court, everything has shifted. It's almost a tectonic shift in many ways, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that has become clear since Samuel Alito replaced Justice O'Connor in 2006 is just how significant that change has been. I do believe that John Roberts is more conservative than William Rehnquist, whom he replaced. But there is no question. I did an interview with Ruth Bader Ginsburg recently for The New Yorker, and she said, just sort of in passing when we were talking, she said, you know, basically the first year that Alito joined the court, every 5-4 decision where Alito was in the majority, he would have been in the minority had O'Connor still stayed on the court, including extremely important cases like Citizens United, which Justice O'Connor has said she would have voted on the other side. So, you know, the Alito for O'Connor shift, I couldn't agree more, looks only bigger and bigger as time has passed.
And getting back to the voting rights, which is also coming up for some adjudication and decision-making, this is Section 5 we're talking about largely, which requires states, and this is especially true in the South, to get federal approval to change the voting laws. Now, there's been a lot of talk about, again, Justice Roberts cited the higher number of people who turn out in Mississippi to vote than in Massachusetts. So you can see where at least he's looking at, I guess.
Right. And there was a Voting Rights Act case that, oddly enough, also came out of Austin, Texas, a couple of years ago, where Roberts very much previewed his opinion that the Voting Rights Act had outlived its usefulness. Again, the court kind of punted on the substantive issue in that case, the earlier Austin case, but I don't think there's any chance they're going to punt this time. And again, as in so many of these cases, I think it's really going to be up to Anthony Kennedy to decide what the future is, because when you look at the records of John Roberts, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Clarence Thomas, Alito, Roberts, Justice Scalia, and Thomas, those four are clearly against affirmative action, against voting rights. And the question is, what does Kennedy do?
Well, it's always sort of up to what Kennedy's going to do in so many of these cases. But what about striking down these preclearance provisions? What does that mean exactly with the voting rights?
Well, again, just to refresh people who probably don't, you know, have the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act on the tip of their tongues. In 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, Lyndon Johnson and the Congress that passed it said, you know, we cannot trust these states with histories of discrimination. It's basically 9 states in the South with a few counties elsewhere, that we can't trust them to manage their own voting rights decisions. So basically, we're going to put these states into receivership. We are going to say, if you want to do anything with regard to your election procedures, whether it's redistricting, whether it's the location of polling places, you are going to have to get what's called preclearance. You are going to have the United States Department of Justice approve these plans before they go into effect. And I don't think anyone doubts that that has been the key factor in getting black people to vote in the South. Now, the argument that Roberts and others have advanced is it's not 1965 anymore. And we have an African-American president, and the South is very different now than it was in 1965. And you can't keep penalizing the South for the sins of the fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers indefinitely, so the law is unconstitutional.
Yeah, in fact, I was reading in Forbes, which may indeed echo the more conservative view on this, that this is a partisan weapon cloaked in the noble history of civil rights. But we're talking to Jeffrey Toobin, by the way, author most recently of The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, which is now available in trade paperback. And I'm wondering, getting back to the fact that there are such sharp divisions between liberals and conservatives on the court, with Justice Kennedy sort of mediating somewhere in between. Why is it that, in your judgment, Jeffrey Toobin, that there's been little action on the part of the Obama administration, almost lack of not only desire for change, but not even submitting judges for lower courts?
It's one of the great mysteries of the Obama administration. When you consider that the president is the former president of the Harvard Law Review, a constitutional law teacher at the University of Chicago, someone who knows these issues very well. The fact that he really neglected his enormous power to nominate judges is one of the mysteries. Now, I think what happened was in the first 2 years of his administration, when he had the control of 60 senators and really could have pushed through a lot of judges, there were some problems in the White House getting up to speed. There was the belief on the part of some of his top staff people, like Rahm Emanuel, that you had to focus on one thing at a time, and that was first the stimulus bill and then health care, and you couldn't burden the system with other controversies. But a tremendous opportunity was lost. Now, I think in President Obama's second term, he is picking up the pace, and he has finally had someone confirmed for the D.C. Circuit, Sri Srinivasan. He just nominated three more nominees in the D.C. Circuit. I think he will not do as well as he might have had he started from the beginning, but clearly he is picking up the pace of nominations. But the Republican obstruction is considerable as well.
Yeah, and you wonder if this might, I think at one point you even said it's almost as if there was disinterest or something like disinterest. You know, this is a constitutional law professor who's also now been criticized for NSA and IRS and Verizon and all of these recent kind of revelations, as if a lot of the focus, at least particularly for the first administration, was on the Affordable Care Act and on almost that exclusively to sort of bypass other things of equal importance to many people. I want to focus on that with you for a moment, in fact, because the thesis of your book, which is really a fascinating one, is that the Roberts Court, with its partisan agenda, it was looking at Gore v. Bush of 2000. It was looking at Citizens United and probably didn't want to necessarily look as partisan as it might be. And so it got the Commerce Clause to look less political and back affordable care as a tax. But that, in the long term, goes to the favor and goes to the credit of what may be, again, a conservative agenda.
Yes. You're referring to last year's decision, almost exactly a year ago, in the Affordable Care Act case. And that was where Chief Justice Roberts, for the one and only time in his tenure, sided with the four liberals, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, to uphold most of the Affordable Care Act. I don't want to give you the impression that I somehow predicted that. I was as stunned, probably more stunned than anyone, and I think Chief Justice Roberts' rationale remains something of a mystery to me. It is true, as you point out, that his stated rationale, that the law was permissible as a tax but not under the Commerce Clause, does give conservatives a wedge potentially in the future to knock down future attempts at activist government. I've written that, and I think that's true. But
well, it makes the Chief Justice seem very cunning. And
it does, but it also, it's really long-term and it's speculative. What's important today is that the Affordable Care Act lives, and that's what really matters out of that decision. And Roberts knew that he was giving Obama a tremendous victory, and he did it anyway. And that, to this day, remains rather astonishing to me.
Well, except that it's, of course, going to be fought all the way in a Republican-dominated Congress. But you're saying, in effect, that Obama and Roberts have never really been on the same page, and that, well, I suppose I'll use your language here, Roberts is a partisan apostle of change.
Yes. I mean, what's very interesting about the two of them is how similar they are in certain respects and how different. They are both sort of the princes of the meritocracy. They are nearly the same age. Roberts is just a couple years older. Obama came of age in Chicago. Roberts grew up near Chicago. They both wound up at Harvard Law School a few years apart. They both excelled in the Harvard Law Review. They both come out of a meritocratic system, but they are so different in their approaches to government and particularly to the Constitution. And Roberts' agenda is really to undo a lot of what the court did in its liberal years under Earl Warren and to a certain extent under Chief Justice Warren Burger. Decisions like Miranda, which gave people the constitutional, the right to remain silent. Certainly, the whole range of civil rights laws that give racial preferences or allow for racial preferences, and again, in an issue that we don't talk about that much these days, but will return to the Supreme Court sooner rather than later, abortion. Roberts has not really voted on many abortion cases yet. But I don't have any doubt he will be one who wants to cut back on Roe v. Wade. And this is an agenda for change that Obama doesn't have.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking to Jeffrey Toobin, who is CNN legal analyst and also staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. And you are invited to join us. In fact, we welcome your calls and your involvement in the program. It's toll free to join us now at 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program at that number. Toll free again, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have onto our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And as we're coming up on a break, I have to ask you about Snowden and the whistleblowing. You took a very strong stance. Jeffrey Toobin?
Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. I found out just how many people on Twitter hate me by what I wrote about Snowden on the New Yorker's website.
Well, hold that thought because we are coming up on a break here. We'll find out what you wrote sort of more maybe in line with Dick Cheney than one would expect from Jeffrey Toobin. And this question that people have sort of simplistically put about that case, traitor or hero. But we'll also take your calls, and again, you can join us. We're talking about the Supreme Court cases, which are coming up, and the Supreme Court and how really one is to read the partisan and political machinations maybe behind the decisions that are being made. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and within the next few weeks, the United States Supreme Court is set to release several major decisions on a range of hot-button issues, including same-sex marriage and the use of race in undergraduate admissions. New Yorker staff writer Jeffrey Toobin is with us talking about the big cases that face the court and about his new book, which is called The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. And we certainly would like to hear from you if you have some strong opinions about the cases, if you're looking for information on any of them or trying to understand them or want to let us know where you stand, you are certainly welcome to join the program. Again, there are a number of ways to do that. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. or you can post any questions or comments immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And, of course, also go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, at KQED Forum. If you have questions about the cases or if you simply, as I said, would like to know what's behind them, we have one of the nation's really premier legal analysts with us in Jeffrey Toobin, who is staff writer for The New Yorker and a CNN legal analyst. And before we went to the break, we were talking about Edward Snowden and the monitoring of phone calls. And you got a lot of Twitter blowback on that, huh?
I certainly did. I just think you can't have a country where it's this kind of behavior goes on, that he is not a public servant. What he did was wrong. This was not his information to disclose. It was a crime. And he is engaging in an act of civil disobedience without accepting the consequences of civil disobedience by running off to China and helping China, which is exactly the opposite of the free speech supporting nation that he claims to want. I just think it's wrong. And while I think these issues of surveillance are important to discuss and it's good to focus attention on them, I think his behavior is criminal and inappropriate and completely inappropriate.
You want a quick response from a listener?
Well, you know, I've heard it all, but I'm happy to hear more.
Well, you may have heard this too, but here's what one of our listeners writes. I like Toobin's analysis of the Supreme Court. I'm thinking he should probably stay out of other subjects, such as the Snowden affair, where his analysis widely misses the mark. We're heading into a third week of revelations which have really rocked the world, but Toobin thinks we should know none of this and that Snowden is not a whistleblower.
She's right. He or she is right. I do not think he's a whistleblower. Whistleblowers point out crimes, violations of law. No one has claimed that the programs that Snowden revealed were illegal. In fact, the first revelation was a court order authorizing.
No, but the argument has been that that the government was going against the Constitution. Of course, you're aware of that. I mean, that's
I'm aware of that, but that is not up to 29-year-old junior employees to decide. I mean, it is one thing to say the government is violating the law, and here it is, but to just claim in the abstract this program, which has been authorized by all three branches of government, is a violation of the Constitution, that's not how our system works. And you know what? There are very responsible, very conscientious members of the United States Senate, like Mark Udall, like Jeff Merkley, who care about these issues and have been trying to raise them. He could have gone to those senators who are very supportive. He could have done any number of things, but simply throwing open files, jeopardizing the work of thousands of people and billions of dollars is just not something I'm prepared to endorse.
Well, let me get your response to a couple of comments on gay marriage from listeners. Let me just read a couple of these. One listener writes, what would be the benefits of the state getting out of the marriage business entirely and allowing citizens to form and break personal relationships and cohabitation agreements as they please? Treat each as an individual before the state in the area of taxation, et cetera, only intervene in the support of minor children. And another listener says, this being a constitutional republic, not a theocracy, it perplexes me how anyone could be against equal protection under the law per marriage for two adults who desire to marry. Could Mr. Toobin speak to the issue of marriage history and how it had more to do with protecting male property rights? Or am I the only one who remembers that up until the last 20 years or so, when a couple was pronounced married, they were declared man and wife, not husband and wife?
Okay, those are two very, very different points. The first is, you know, why should we have marriage at all? And, you know, I think the answer is
they both go to the heart of the history of marriage. So.
Well, some of them have to. Yeah, they're related. But, you know, the people want to get married. Straight people want to get married. Straight people want to get married. And the society has decided that there are advantages for the society to have these sort of enduring bonds, whether it's for the stability of the society as a whole, whether it's for the raising of children. I don't have a problem with society defining marriage as an institution that gives you certain benefits, whether it's tax benefits or ability to visit people in the hospital or custody advantages. I think marriage as an institution is very much a net positive for our society, regardless of what the history may have been which certainly, you know, speaks to the history of discrimination against women. Today, I think marriage is a good institution. The question for our society now is who should have access to that institution? And I think many people, including me, are coming to the answer that everyone should have access to it, that it is not something that should be reserved exclusively for straight people, that gay people should have this advantage. I think it's very important to draw a distinction between the religious role of marriage and the civic role. Whatever happens to Proposition 8, the Catholic Church in California and everywhere else is going to be able to make up its own mind about whether to allow gay people to marry in its church. And currently, and for the foreseeable future, Catholic churches are going to say, no, we're only going to marry straight couples. That is completely up to the Catholic Church under the First Amendment. There is nothing the government can do to affect that decision. However, marriage is a legal concept, which has lots of legal implications that have nothing to do with religion. And that's the question about whether gay people should have access to all of those legal advantages that go with marriage. That's what these cases are really about.
But here we get into the political side of religion. The Catholic Church and the Mormon Church and certainly other religious groups have certainly tried to bring politics to bear by contributing a great deal of money in the Proposition 8 campaign.
Certainly, that was true for the Mormon Church and the Proposition 8 campaign, and it's true that many Catholic officials, you know, cardinals, and other members of the Catholic clergy have spoken out against same-sex marriage. But that's their right under the First Amendment. They're allowed to express opinions about whether they think society should recognize. Should recognize same-sex marriages. I don't have any problem with that. For the First Amendment guarantees them the right to speak out. It also guarantees them the right not to be told what to do in their churches about same-sex marriage. But just as everyone else has the right to speak their minds, so do these people, so do the Mormons, and so do Catholics.
And we'll have our listeners speak their minds. Let's go to Carla first here. Carla, you're on.
I wanted to comment, and going back to the Snowden issue, on the basis of my personal experience, I would say our system is broken in that we do not have checks and balances. Like I'm 55 years old. I always assumed there was a place to go when something happened where you were suspected there was some government abuse of something. There's nowhere to go. I can tell you on the basis of my own personal experience with that, some stuff happened. Number of years ago, I had it investigated by an ex-CIA person, by somebody who was offered a job at the highest level of security clearance, and one of those people said to me, you know, you are an activist against the Iraq War. You should not rule out that you might be, based on everything you're telling us, this is a professional situation, and you should not rule out that you're being harassed by somebody in the government. You just shouldn't rule that out. And I wrote to my state senators, I wrote to then-Senator Barack Obama and a bunch of other senators, I called Senator Leahy's office, I called everybody, I contacted everybody I could think of, the Attorney General's office, I have gotten nowhere. Barbara Boxer wrote me a letter and said, we can't do the kind of investigation that you're requesting because we don't have access to that. So in other words, we have a problem here, and that is that there's too much power in the hands of too few, and it's beyond reach of the American public when there are abuses. And, you know, I'm a psychologist. There's a monkey in everybody, and the monkey can't resist the curiosity of opening the box, okay? So there's always, we have to assume, there's always going to be some level of abuse going on when you have this kind of access to people's private information.
Carla, let me jump in here. I want to get right to your central point and get Jeffrey Toobin's response to it. I mean, essentially she's saying, in many instances, there's nowhere to go, there's nowhere Snowden could have gone, and that this is a broken system.
Well, certainly, it's not easy, and I don't want to give the impression that it is. I don't think the system of surveillance is broken in this country. I mean, I frankly don't know what the caller didn't get a job that she wanted, and she wanted Barbara Boxer's help. That's not something that senators do. But I don't really see her story as evidence that the system is broken. It is true that we need public discussion of how much surveillance is appropriate. There has been some discussion of that. I see no reason why there shouldn't be more discussion of that. But it shouldn't be up to 29-year-olds who are fleeing to, you know, repressive communist dictatorships with thumb drives in their luggage. That's not the appropriate way to resolve these controversies.
Let me thank Carla for her call. I want to go to another caller, and that's Walter, who's with us from Ann Arbor. Hi, Walter.
Hi, good morning. Hey, look, I'm sorry. I had one comment, though, I wanted to make, but this thing with the Marriage Act between, same-sex people, I have to ask the question. I consider it fine. I don't have a problem with people of the same sex getting married because that, you know, whatever reasons, and I'm an older individual, I think that's been their proxy. The only thing that I find disruptive is the fact that if you want to call this type of union a marriage, if they wanted to call it a same-sex marriage or something, something to denote the difference between a man and a woman, which has been customarily acknowledged throughout our civilization. Does that seem weird to you, or is that reasonable?
Jeffrey Toobin.
I think there is a long history of trying to create categories of people that almost have the same rights but are not the same rights. You know, marriage has important legal and cultural resonances that gay people want equal access to. And as soon as you start creating categories that are almost as good as, but not the same as same-sex marriage, as marriage, that's discrimination. There's a very close parallel to what went on in the 1960s, where there were a lot of people in this country who really thought that interracial marriage was against the laws of God and against all of our cultural traditions, and they really believed that it wasn't discrimination. It was prohibiting blacks and whites on an equal basis from not marrying each other. And the Supreme Court said in 1968, in the famous decision of Loving versus Virginia, that is discrimination that the Constitution will not tolerate. It's essentially the same argument that's being made now about same-sex marriage, that as soon as you say that gay people don't have exactly the same rights as everyone else, it's discrimination, and the Constitution doesn't tolerate it.
Let me thank the caller. Go right on to another caller. And, George, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I want to tell you I'm a great admirer of you, too. I agree with you absolutely on this. I want to draw your attention to Obama missed opportunity.
George, hold on. We're going to try to get a better connection because we're not really hearing you very well.
Yeah, please get a much better connection because he's saying nice things about me. So it's very important that he get to a landline right
Actually,
away.
I think it were about both of us, Jeffrey, but that's okay. we're going to try to get him on a better line here. In the meantime, go to another caller, and that's Bob. Bob, you're on.
I don't know if the speaker feels the same way about Citizens United as I do, but it seems like it's wrong. I was hoping he could make a comment about it. What to do about it, overturn it, so on.
I do think Citizens United is wrong. I think it's a real...
You should mention, for those who don't know, we're talking about the deregulation of campaign finance. Yeah.
In essence, and there are two metaphors that are really at the heart of Citizens United, and one gets talked about a lot and one doesn't get talked about very much. The one that gets talked about a lot is that corporations are treated like people, and a lot of people are offended by that idea. I'm not so offended by that idea. I work for CNN. I work for the New Yorker magazine. We wave the First Amendment all the time, and we're corporations. So the idea that corporations have some First Amendment rights is nothing novel or outrageous. The second metaphor, which is that money is speech, that's much more troubling to me, that the idea of giving to a campaign deserves the same degree of First Amendment protection as giving a speech on a street's corner or writing a book or in a magazine. I think that's a very troubling idea, and that's really at the heart of Citizens United, that the idea that you can't prohibit Sheldon Adelson or a labor union from giving unlimited amounts of money to in support of a political candidate, that's really troubling and dangerous and counter to our traditions And that's where the court is heading with regard to Citizens United, ever more in that direction.
And again, Jeffrey Toobin with us, author most recently of The Oath, the Obama White House and the Supreme Court, now out in trade paperback. He is staff writer for The New Yorker and also CNN legal analyst. And just reading some of your comments here, Stefan tweets, "It's incredible that citizens are not required to show an ID for their registration to vote." Jason writes, "As a longtime attorney, I follow the Supreme Court's decisions as they obviously affect me personally and professionally. However, I firmly recognize that the Supreme Court's Bush v. Gore decision was a theft of the administrative branch engineered by the Supreme Court. Since that time, I must report that I have lost all respect or concern for how the Supreme Court comes to its decisions. I would vote for a presidential candidate who promised to expand the court to 13 members and thereby dilute the power of the coup enactors." And back to the Snowden case, Kit tweets, "What if the material leaked by Snowden is itself the product of a crime? And what evidence do you have he is aiding China?"
Okay. What evidence do we have is aiding China is he's talking about how we are surveying opposing governments. The newest disclosures involve how we, in the British, tap phones and emails at a conference in Great Britain. What does that have to do with civil liberties in the United States? That's just making mischief and of no conceivable civil liberties benefit within the United States. It is just troublemaking.
It's also strange, isn't it, that he would go to China, which is a country known for its surveillance of its citizens, whether it's Hong Kong or China proper?
It's totally bizarre. It's totally bizarre. Now, he says he's going to Hong Kong, which does have a quasi-independent status and does have greater free speech than the mainland, China, the Chinese mainland. But I mean, no, who's kidding whom here? Hong Kong is part of China. There's been a handover of power from the British, and the decisions about national security, including what's going to happen to Snowden, are going to be made in Beijing. They're not going to be made in Hong Kong, and I think it indicates the extremely confused thinking and dangerous thinking that characterizes all of what Snowden has done.
Well, here's that caller, George, that was starting off saying some nice things. We've got you back, George. Please.
Yeah, hi, George. Hi. Again, I'm a great admirer of yours, but I want to take issue with your statement that Obama had 60 votes during his first term. I mean, there are dinos in the state and the U.S. Senate. They're Democrats' name only, very conservative, and would not have backed the kinds of appointments that I think you're suggesting Obama could have made. So that's number one. Number two, I wish you'd start talking about federalism and what a bad deal it is for the majority of people in this country. I mean, it was a great concept in the 18th century for 13 colonies, but, I mean, the majority of the country is at the mercy of the minority, and it certainly isn't democratic.
Well, I mean, it is certainly true that the 60 senators who were nominally Democrats in the first 2 years of Obama's presidency were not all as liberal as Barbara Boxer. There were people like Senator Nelson of Nebraska and Lieberman of Connecticut who did not, who were considerably less liberal, but they were a heck of a lot more sympathetic than the current Senate. And it's not that Obama didn't nominate strong liberals to these judgeships. He just didn't nominate anyone. I mean, these seats have stayed vacant for a very long time. And I think that's the real mystery of the Obama presidency in that regard. As for federalism, this is one of the signatures of American democracy. And people in California, the Affordable Care Act is a classic example. Here in California, you have a governor who has embraced the Affordable Care Act and a state that has embraced it, and citizens are going to have a wide variety of choices of insurance companies. Many governors, especially in the South and in more conservative states, are doing their best to undermine the Affordable Care Act, and there will be very limited choices. I'm a little more philosophical about that. You know, Medicare and Medicaid were not fully adapted by the states when they were passed in the mid-60s, and I think it will be a gradual process. But the history of these things is once there are enormous federal benefits out there, even the more conservative states find it advantageous to sign on eventually.
And I thank George for his call, and I want to go to a caller in Atlanta, Georgia. Paul, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. While I agree with your guest in general that it shouldn't be a 29-year-old's decision to release this information, when you have a government that is hiding it actively from the American people and from Congress, we have to remember that only a handful of Congress and Senate knew about this, and they're using a rubber stamp court, I don't understand how we can have the conversation any other way. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Well, that is... I'd say the best defense that Snowden can get is that there is no other way to raise these issues except illegally. I'm not persuaded that it's true. I think there are other ways of doing it. This is not the first time these subjects have been discussed. They have perhaps not been discussed to this caller's satisfaction. But I think we cannot have a system where any person who has access to classified information is just free to disclose it if it doesn't meet that person's standard of propriety. That's a recipe for chaos, for damage to the country, and I'm not going to endorse it.
Let me go back with you, Jeffrey Toobin, if I may, to the issue of affirmative action. Alec tweets, how does Fisher versus Texas differ from Bollinger, which was the University of Michigan case, or for that matter, for those of you who remember, the Bakke case, the University of California, Davis?
It doesn't differ much at all. That's just the point. The reason why so many people think that the Fisher case, the current one from the University of Texas, is so likely to overturn or limit affirmative action is that it is so similar to the Grutter case from 2003, where the court in a decision by Justice O'Connor basically endorsed affirmative action, and they would not have gone back to the subject, the nearly identical subject, in 10 years later unless they were interested in overturning it.
And another listener, George, writes, the U.S. Constitution originally said nothing about who can vote and gave this power entirely to the states. Now it seems the federal government has the upper hand. When and how did this constitutional power get transferred from the states to the feds? Likewise, the U.S. Constitution requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate for treaties, yet all these free trade treaties pass with a simple majority. How did this transfer of power occur?
It is not entirely, particularly when it comes to voting, the grant to the states is not absolute. And what today's Supreme Court decision is about the motor voter law, and where under President Clinton, Congress passed a law to make voter registration easier. And once this federal government does that, there's a doctrine of law known as preemption, which means the federal government sort of preempts the field. Once the federal government speaks out on a subject, states can't overturn them entirely. And that's what they said the court did.
Well, the Arizona case,
the state did.
I'm just wondering, is this the first time that Clarence Thomas has not and Scalia voted on different sides, or Thomas hasn't voted with Scalia?
Not the first time. I would say it's definitely unusual, but it's not the first time. They have different views on some rather esoteric subjects like jury trial issues, like certain sentencing issues, but they vote together most of the time, just as the four liberals vote together most of the time. But there are a handful of issues that the usual categories break down.
Are you getting a lot of flack on the Snowden case? What about calling Scalia a right-wing crank? You still getting flack on that?
Well, that was a reference to a dissenting opinion he wrote last term about the Arizona law that was really uncharacteristically caustic, even for him. And, you know, he's almost 80 years old, and my experience with people who are almost 80 years old is they come to be even more like themselves. And there's a reason why people retire before they're 80. But Supreme Court justices stay on. They generally stay on until they have a president they like. And so Scalia is not going anywhere as long as Obama's president, if he has anything to say about it.
You just raised a very important issue that I remember studying back as a kid in the civics class when my great civics teacher, Mr. Roach, said, you know, these Supreme Court lifetime appointments, what if they get senile? You can't remove them. There's nothing you can do about it. And he was right.
Well, they can be impeached, just like the president can be impeached. It's never happened, although there have been efforts along the way. You know, it's one of those vestiges of an 18th century constitution. You know, when the Constitution was written, people were expected to die in their 50s. So the idea of 20 and 30 year tenures on the Supreme Court was not something that was very much on the framers' mind, because you know, you'd be a distinguished lawyer in your 30s or 40s and then you'd serve for about a decade. But now, of course, we live in a world, fortunately, where people regularly live on into their 80s. So presidents make Supreme Court appointments with the age of the person very much in mind, so they can serve for 20, 30 years. The idea of term limits or mandatory retirement, I think, is a good one, but you'd need an amendment to the Constitution, and I'm not holding my breath.
I'm going to read one more email because it's positive, and you'll like it. Peter says, as a very liberal, progressive Democrat, I, for one, agree completely with Mr. Toobin's appraisal of the Snowden issue. He is totally correct. Bravo. I also very much enjoy his articles in The New Yorker. A good note to end on. Jeffrey Toobin, always good to have you aboard.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you again. His book, his new one, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. When we return, you know, going to an entirely different subject. We're going to talk about Humboldt County and pot growing and pot production and the whole secretive economy up there with an author, Emily Brady, who's written a book on Humboldt County. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.